This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have on my show Jonathan Alter, longtime national affairs columnist for Newsweek and frequent MSNBC analyst. Jonathan Alter wrote a bestseller on FDR called The Defining Moment, and his new book is called The Promise, President Obama Year One. Jonathan Alter, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hey, thanks very much, Matt. It's, your listeners should know that you and I have known each other for in 30 years.
Yeah, we go back.
So I'm
back,
really happy to be here.
We go back quite a ways. Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I think you and I combined have had the same job longer than any other two journalists in America. We're supposed.
I think that is correct.
Funny. We've been supposed to be.
It's a little sad, but true.
sad, but true. Anyway, let's get to the heart of it here. Most progressives I talk to have had one overwhelming reaction to Obama, I think it's fair to say, over the last year and a half, and that is disappointment. Are we wrong to be disappointed?
I believe you are. And that's not to say that there are not certain areas where he's disappointed me. That's not to say, I think he's been a perfect president. As Frank Rich just wrote in last week's New York Review of Books when he was reviewing my book, The Promise is not hagiography. It's not, it's got some very sharp criticism of Obama in it. But I don't think that that's the right word to describe one's reaction to him. I think it should be a mixed assessment. And I think that, to have disappointment be the frame is to ignore the several historic things that he's accomplished, and to downplay a number of sort of data points that suggest something to the contrary, which I'm glad we'll have some time to explore.
Yeah, why don't you just say what you think his biggest accomplishments are that maybe go underrated?
Well, the first is that he prevented another Great Depression. When Obama took office in January of 2009, we were losing 750 thousand jobs a month. If we had stayed on that path and without very dramatic Keynesian action, we would have stayed on that path. If we had stayed on that path, we would have had another Great Depression by the end of 2009. That's not an exaggeration. That's not like a sepia tinted point. That's the truth. We would have lost so many jobs that we would have been literally comparable to what was going on in the period that I wrote my last book about, the early 1930s. So that didn't happen for a variety of reasons, and a series of, policy initiatives, some of which involved, a much more active Federal Reserve. But the combination of the $700 billion TARP program and the $787 billion stimulus program, the Recovery Act, prevented a depression. Now, I'm critical of Obama in the chapters on the economy because I think he should have used his leverage over the banks to restructure those banks in early 2009. And I wish he had.
No,
I don't think he needed to nationalize mm-hmm. them. And progressives who said that nationalization was necessary have turned out to be wrong, because they paid back the money, and it would have cost, nationalization would have cost us another $1 trillion that we could afford. But the idea that they should have been, that Obama should have dictated terms to the banks at that time, I completely agree with. And he didn't do it, for a lot of reasons that I explained. He had, I'm not happy with the smallness of the circle of economic advisors around him, led by Larry Summers and Tim Geithner. I think he needed a much broader circle. But you know, to ignore that the stress tests worked, that the stimulus was huge, Paul Krugman's complaints notwithstanding, is ahistorical.
But, Jonathan, let's just talk about Krugman's criticism there. I mean, he and Joseph Stiglitz were saying from the get-go that the stimulus package needed to be 50% bigger than it was. I was interested in reading in your book that Christine Romer, the Council of Economic Advisors, had, under Obama, had initially come forward with a $1.2 trillion price tag.
Right.
But it sounds like the political people were skittish of that trillion-dollar figure and stepped back from it. But in hindsight, it looks like maybe they should have gone for it, right?
Well, I think they should have gone for it. And, you know, on the economics, you know, clearly Stiglitz and Krugman are right. But, you know, we don't live in a world of magic wands. You know, just to give you a little bit of context, Matt, at the time when they were debating stimulus, when Obama was the president-elect in late 2008, Ed Rendell, you know, very Mr. Infrastructure, the governor of Pennsylvania, you know, he wanted as big a stimulus as possible. And when somebody said, do you think we could get a $300 billion stimulus? He goes, oh, my God, that would be fantastic. That would be beyond my wildest expectations. You've got to remember that Pelosi and Reid in the fall of 2008 had tried and failed to get a $150 billion stimulus. So the politics are stubborn things, you know, and you could say, well, you're disappointed in Obama that he didn't get a $1 trillion stimulus. But if the most, you know, the most progressive president in the world couldn't have gotten a $1 trillion stimulus because the politics didn't allow it. Mm-hmm. So why should one be disappointed in Obama for that? You can say, well, I'm disappointed in the American political system. I'm disappointed that these clowns in Washington, you know, didn't read Paul Krugman's column more intently. But it's hard to blame Obama for that. And, you know, they got it through. They got it through fast. He played bad poker, and I was critical of him for putting the $300 billion in tax cuts on the table at the front end of the process. He should have waited and used that as a bargaining chip. And he might have gotten, you know, conceivably gotten some Republican support, though probably not. So you could blame him for that. You could say that the mix of tax cuts and infrastructure projects was not right. But I think a lot of people who criticize the stimulus don't have a clue what was actually in it, you know, and there was a lot in it. It was really it went through so fast. There's really five or six major pieces of legislation in one. You know, it doubled medical and scientific research, for instance. And, you know, it was the biggest energy bill in history by far. Not what, you know, not a price on carbon like you and I would favor. And there's plenty of disappointment on energy policy in the months since. But you know, at the beginning of last year, it was really a very significant investment in alternative energy. And you know, and the biggest infrastructure bill since the Highway Act of the 1950s and all kinds of other things that were in there. I didn't think there were enough visible projects in there. And I favored, you know, I'm more of an FDR man. I favored direct hiring, WPA style hiring by the government, which they didn't undertake for a variety of political reasons. But, you know, I think that to be disappointed by the stimulus for a progressive, I think is really unrealistic, and that in many areas, Barack Obama is the most progressive president that any progressive could hope for, and that the system will allow. And so what I'm looking for from progressives is a little bit more realism.
Jonathan Alter is the author of The Promise, President Obama Year One. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. Why didn't he go? You mentioned a couple of political reasons for a WPA-type jobs program.
Well, you know, he was, first of all, I don't think it came up. I asked a number of people in the White House about it. I didn't, when I interviewed the president, I didn't ask him about it because I used the time for other things. But, you know, the trend had been so much against this, even on the part of Democratic mayors who for years now have been contracting out rather than doing direct hiring. And I think that trend has gone much too far, and it's not even cost effective, all this use of contractors. But, you know, I think they felt that the money could be infused into the economy to prevent a depression and get spent faster with contractors than the government directly hiring. You know, a lot of it was government hiring because the state stabilization fund, as it was called, the part of the stimulus, couple hundred billion dollars of it, that, you know, went to the states. Most of that went to state and local government. And so the federal government didn't have much control over whether they set up their own programs or contracted out. And in many, many cases, they were contracting out. But for the state and local workers, and it prevented massive layoffs. Fortunately, you know, just this week, the Senate has approved a bill against all odds to with $10 billion to prevent a whole new wave of teacher layoffs that were coming without it. So it is a constant battle. There's no help from the Republicans. When I asked the president and last year what his biggest disappointment was, his biggest surprise in his first year, he said it was that the other party wasn't more interested in governing. And I would actually go further than that and say, you know, the other party wasn't patriotic, because at a time when the country was in deep trouble and he was reaching out to them in January and February of 2009 to join with him, the way the Democrats had joined with Ronald Reagan when he came to office, you know, on parts of his program, the way the Republicans joined with Franklin Roosevelt when he came to office when the economy was in tough shape, and they decided that their short-term political interests derived from, you know, a policy of obstruction outweighed the need of the country, and then 98 of them, this is a figure I love, Matt, 98 Republican members of the House cut ribbons or put out press releases on stimulus projects that they voted against. That's just some sort of new indoor record for hypocrisy and chutzpah.
And having it both ways. I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter. He's the author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One. In that section of your book, John, I thought President Obama seemed almost a little naive about bipartisanship, and I remembered one of the debates he had with Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail where he was singing his bipartisan song, and Hillary kind of gave him a withering look and said, look, you don't understand what it's like here in Washington. These people hate us, and we're just going to have to slug it out. Don't you think, to some degree, he was expecting more than he should have?
I think that would be a fair criticism of him. He's not a naive guy, you know, generally. But on this point, I think he was trapped between what he had promised during the campaign, which was, you know, a less partisan tone in Washington, and what the realities of Washington were. The very first cover story that ever appeared about Barack Obama was in Newsweek in late 2004 when he had been elected but not yet sworn into the Senate. And I went down to Washington and interviewed him, the cover that we put was, the cover line was Seeing Purple. Remember, when he first, you know, burst on the scene at the 2004 convention, it was seeing beyond red and blue. You know, we pray to an awesome God in the blue states, and we have gay friends in the red states. And I remember that whole thing. That was his speech.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's a very unsentimental guy, but he thought he's so confident. I think it was more overconfidence than naivete. He's so confident in his own abilities that he thought that he could be different in terms of reaching the better angels of their nature. You know, he's always thinking about Lincoln able to reach out to people on the other side. And it didn't work. And the biggest mistake they made in healthcare was that, as one of his aides put it to me, you know, we should have said much earlier, it's over, Max Baucus and his efforts to craft a bipartisan bill in the Senate Finance Committee.
Yeah.
And they should have just ran the sucker through, much earlier.
Yeah, I saw that quote in your book, Jonathan Alter, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. And my interpretation before I read the book was that Obama, basically offloaded the details of health care and didn't really mind that Max Baucus was going slow on it. And I had read somewhere that Rahm Emanuel was in constant contact with him, so I kind of thought that, the administration was fine with that slow pace.
Oh, God, no. They were driving them completely bonkers. And I was talking to them as this was going on. It was driving them nuts. And Rahm Emanuel's deputy, a guy named Jim Messina, is from Montana, and he's from out west, and he worked as Baucus' chief of staff. And he was like a son to Baucus, and he had dinner with him. Baucus was going through a divorce, and Messina had dinner with him every week in the summer of 2009, just pleading with him, can you just forget about Grassley? Cut a deal with Olympia Snowe, move the sucker, move the bill. And for reasons that related to his, good relationship with Chuck Grassley, he kept saying, no, I got to do it my way. Now, some critics said, well, why didn't the administration just have Harry Reid bring it to the floor? The hell with the Senate Finance Committee. Just bring it directly to the floor. And the answer to that is that if he had, these prideful senators on the Senate Finance Committee, Democrats, wouldn't have voted for it, and we would have had what happened in 1994 with the Clinton plan. So there are these process questions. You know, Matt, I was just today talking to my wife about process when we were driving into New York, and, she's just like so tired of process. But this is the way change actually happens, and it's very frustrating. It's much slower than anybody would want. But the health care bill is the biggest piece of social legislation in 45 years. 45 years ago this week, Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare and Medicaid. This bill, despite lacking a public option, which I mean, I'm a single payer man, but I, strongly for a public option. And I was wrong at the beginning of 2009 when I wrote in Newsweek that the bill, wasn't worth that much without a public option. It's got so much unbelievable stuff that is buried in this bill that is really good for this country. I mean, an expert on the bill who I saw earlier this week who worked for Ted Kennedy reminded me there's a provision in the healthcare bill that for the first time treats elder abuse like child abuse, because all over the country in nursing homes you're having older people getting whacked around, and there's been no legislation on the books to prevent it. And this bill in that 2,000 pages, and there's about 20 other things like that. So I think that most of the criticism of the bill is unwarranted, and it's not the bill I would have wanted, but it is a huge advance for this country, and it puts into American history, into our past shameful era that went on for so long, where, if you got sick, or your child got sick, you had to sell your house. And that's in the past now, when this is fully implemented. And insuring 31 million Americans is nothing to sneeze at.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter. He's the author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One. You might see him on MSNBC sometimes, Rachel Maddow, for instance. And I'm sure if you've been reading Newsweek anytime in the last couple of decades, you've seen his column. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. Jonathan, on healthcare, I just thought he played progressives on this public option thing kind of for chumps, because he would throw it out there in speeches, and then he would undercut it, and then he'd say something positive about it, and then he'd say it's just a sliver. And it seemed to me that he never really was in favor of it and was always willing to throw it overboard.
Well, I don't like the way he handled it, and I do think I actually agree with your characterization. I think he played the supporters for Trump's, but that's not because he wasn't for it. It's because when they counted heads in the spring, they realized that it wasn't going to happen. The support wasn't there. They had maybe, they had in the Senate, they had between 40 and 45 votes for a public option.
So now, are you sure on that?
No way they were, I mean, no way they were going to get, there was no way they were going to get those 15 votes. Now, some people said maybe they had 50 votes. But there's just no, they weren't even close to having 60 votes for a public option in the Senate. So what happened was, you know, he tried to do this balancing act where he didn't want to, what he should have done is he should have just said what I just said in May of 2009. He should have said, you know what, should have said to the progressives, it's not happening, but this bill is really great for other reasons. You got to remember that the public option was not mentioned a single time in a single speech, a single debate, or single position paper during the 2008 campaign. There's a lot of talk about choice and competition, but it was always, you know, the debate for the last 30 years has been about universal coverage. And somehow, you know, a lot of us, and I include myself, we got fixated on the public option. And then once we all got fixated on it, then Obama had to, you know, do a tap dance on the subject, even though he didn't want to, you know, it's a lot easier for me to sit in, you know, my office at Newsweek or you at the Progressive or whatever and say, you know, this is the way things should be than it is to actually count noses in a very dysfunctional chamber of Congress, the United States Senate, and make hard choices. And so, you know, when Howard Dean said at the end of 2009, kill the bill, this is not a public option, something he doesn't remind us of very much anymore that he was saying that, Harry Reid said, you know, kill Howard Dean. And by that point, I was with Harry Reid because it was, you know, it was such a throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of view. And I wish that, you know, like I admit, you know, I pride myself on admitting when I make mistakes. I was wrong in early 2009 to write that the, Glenn Greenwald is happy to remind me of this, you know, I was wrong to write that the public option was, you know, the most, without that, the bill wasn't worth anything. I wish other people would admit that. I wish Krugman would admit that he was wrong that the banks had to be nationalized. Krugman and Stiglitz, they both have Nobel Prizes, but it didn't have to happen. You know, they were able to, the stress tests worked to get them back to some health, and the runs on the nationalized banks wouldn't have been worth it. And so sometimes history moves on, and people have to acknowledge, you know, mistakes. And this, I tell you what, when I realized that the public option wasn't do or die is when somebody started asking me about Social Security. And I reflected back on the chapter that I wrote in A Defining Moment on the history of Social Security and how that bill went down. And then in 1935, and remember, Roosevelt waited 2 years after coming to office before introducing Social Security. Obama introduced health care in his first year over the objections of Joe Biden, Rahm Emanuel, Christina Romer, you know, David Axelrod, Byron Dorgan, Chuck Schumer, everybody else said, don't do health care your first year. This is one of the big revelations in the promise, you know, for me in researching it, and I think for readers as well. The idea of being disappointed with him on health care is crazy. He was the driving force behind it, the president. So when I started to realize that is when I reflected on Social Security. In 1935, first Roosevelt stalled for 2 years. Francis Perkins, his labor secretary, was pushing him. He wouldn't do it. He finally introduces this bill. The New Dealers, the liberals of the time, are enraged by this bill because it ensures fewer than 40% of senior citizens, and it is thoroughly racist. It is written in such such a way that any occupation that blacks held in the 1930s was excluded from the bill by Southern racists in the Senate who, you know, wanted to make sure that the blacks in their states were not eligible for Social Security. So a lot of liberals wanted Roosevelt to withdraw the bill because it wasn't good enough. And his view and Obama's view is you've got to start somewhere and that they would be able to go back as they did and fix Social Security and build on it, change it, extend coverage. This is what's going to happen with health care. It's going to be fixed in many ways, but it is a landmark piece of legislation, and I think progressives should appreciate it.
It'll be fixed unless Republicans manage to torpedo it if they gain a lot of power and
right,
if next time around.
Power.
But, Jonathan,
right,
just...
So how are they going to gain power, Matt? I mean, this is... I'm sorry to...
No, it's okay.
On my high horse here, but how are they going to gain power if progressives sit on their hands? You know, last summer, these famous town meetings, even in Democratic districts, they were packed by conservatives and Tea Party folks. Where were the liberals?
Well,
they were disappointed with
right.
Barack Obama, so they didn't show up. They won Miller time. They thought, oh, okay, well, we voted for Obama. Now it's up to him. Our job's over. We can have a beer and let him perform. Well, that's not the way politics works. It's never worked that way. So I hope liberals will get off their fannies and go out and prevent these clowns from taking control of our Congress this fall. And if they don't, they'll have, at least in a partial way, they'll have themselves to blame.
Well, I agree about the clowns, but I don't think people are on Miller time. I just don't think that Obama was doing enough to please the base. And so the base, a lot of them stayed home. Not all of them stayed home. Some did go to those meetings. We only have about a minute left, Jonathan Alter, and not enough time really to talk about Afghanistan, but that's the other huge issue. And this is something that progressives across the board are not appreciating about Obama.
Well, just a couple quick things. First of all, I personally, I support the Biden plan. You know, very few troops, use of Predator drones to attack al-Qaeda targets. It's important to understand, though, that Obama, there's no betrayal here. He always promised during the campaign that he was going to escalate in Afghanistan. And the total number of troops, with his having just this week, he's fulfilled his promise on Iraq. The total number of troops in the region is much, much less than it was, it has been in the past. And, so even with the 30,000 additional troops, the rapid de-escalation, from Iraq, more than compensates for that. So I don't say that to excuse a policy that I don't favor. I tell it at considerable length in the promise because I got fascinated by his process of making a decision. And I asked him at one point, were you jammed by the Pentagon? And he said, quote, I neither confirm nor deny that I was jammed by the Pentagon.
Jonathan Alter's been my guest today on Progressive Radio. He is the author of The Promise, President Obama, Year One. Thanks, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.